We now bring you an excerpt of an interview with Jav Parrish, analyzing recent news. Jav Parrish is co-editor of Eat the State, and Mind Over Matters interviewed him on April 29th, 2006.
We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
We got so much to pack in today. I'm just not even going to start with the niceties.
Probably a good idea.
Moving along, there was a sit-in this week in Maria Cantwell's office.
Yes, and you probably didn't hear anything about it unless you maybe read The Stranger's blog or the new Eat the State that's come out. I think KUOW had something on it on Tuesday when seven activists went into Maria Cantwell's office at noon and said that they weren't going to leave until Maria Cantwell changed her position on the war, basically. They had about 90 minutes on the phone with a senior aide in Washington, D.C., who gave the usual apologetics. And then 5:30 came when the building normally closed and they expected to get arrested. And Cantwell's staff was so sensitive about the possibility of publicity around this, and obviously they did a pretty good job of suppressing the publicity since it wasn't covered by the dailies, wasn't covered by any TV stations, etc., that they kept the office open all night. Two of Cantwell's staffers stayed all night so that there was one woman in the group, and she decided to bow out at 5:30 because she didn't want to be the only woman who's arrested and separated out and sent to jail. But the six people that were remaining, including the father of the local father of a or a soldier who was killed in Iraq, several other people who were involved in military families, Rich Gamble, pastor of a local church, Howard Gale, who's been involved in a lot of anti-war organizing. I mean, you know, people that are fairly prominent in the anti-war movement in this area. Six folks stayed. They stayed all night. They stayed into the following day, and at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, they suspended the sit-in when they got an agreement from Cantwell to meet with them when she's back in town during a congressional recess on May 6th. What they're saying is if the results of that meeting are not satisfactory, they reserve the right to start the sit-in all over again. And, if they do, maybe they'll have some other folks joining them this time, because hopefully we can publicize it a little farther. But this is one of a number of sit-ins that have occurred around the country against mostly Democratic senators who have either supported the war or have been urged to do more to oppose the war. There was one last month where 19 people were arrested in Ron Wyden's Portland office. So this is something that's happening around the country, and hopefully we can see more of it here, because we definitely need to see more pressure, particularly put on Maria Cantwell around her support of the war.
All right, and Cantwell this week filed a complaint?
Yeah, actually it was the Democratic Party that did on behalf of Cantwell against Mike McGavick, her Republican opponent, probably in the general election. McGavick, of course, is the former CEO of Safeco and an insurance industry lobbyist. When he decided to resign his position at Safeco in order to run for the Senate, Safeco provided him with a very, very nice golden parachute. Now, it turns out not only did they do that, but they kept him on the payroll until after January 1st as a quote-unquote consultant, and by doing so gave him an additional $13 million worth of stock options. There's a total of $17 million that they've given McGavick after he announced for Senate. And what the Democrats are alleging is that this basically is a backdoor campaign contribution, money that Gavick can then turn around and pour into his Senate campaign, and he's already put a fair amount of his own money into the campaign. It'll be very, very interesting to see how the FEC handles this complaint. It's a fairly major complaint, and one that I think is, you know, pretty justified, because clearly Safeco is, what they're doing is making an awful lot of money available to McGavick at the exact same time that he also coincidentally needs an awful lot of money to run for the U.S. Senate.
All right. Karl Rove getting some special attention this week.
Yes. Jason Leopold of Truth Out, who I've quoted on this show before, was reporting yesterday that Patrick Fitzgerald, now that he's coming off of his successful conviction of Illinois Governor George Ryan on corruption charges, is turning his full attention to the Valerie Plame Wilson case. And he is asking a grand jury this week to consider indicting Rove. And he wants to do it on charges of perjury, on charges of lying to investigators in 2003. The perjury was to a grand jury in 2004, and a possibility also of obstruction of justice, depending on what Rove said when he was called to testify before the grand jury again this past Wednesday. So look for that. If the grand jury decides to go along with it, there will be an announcement probably on Friday. And that could obviously throw a big monkey wrench into the Republicans' plans to have Rove mastermind their attempt to hang on to the control of the Senate and the House in 2006. So it could be a very, very big deal, not just for the indictment of Rove, but for what it means for Republicans' election chances in 2006. Meantime, very interestingly, there's another case going on in which two AIPAC lobbyists, that's right, there is an Israeli lobby, even though you may have read that there's not, are accused of trying to obtain classified information. And the lawyers for those said this week that the source of the classified information for the lobbyists that are now being charged with trying to obtain it were several senior administration officials, including none other than Condoleezza Rice. So in addition to President Bush having been outed as leaking classified information, it looks like Condoleezza Rice now is also being outed for the same thing. And leaking it, in this case, to a sympathetic pro-Israel lobby. So keep an eye on this one as well.
All right, moving along. John Conyers is looking at suing.
Not looking at doing. He's done it. Ten congressional Democrats, led by John Conyers, are suing over the little stunt that's been pulled by President Bush, where in a budget bill that was passed in February had a late amendment added to it that included some additional money for an entitlement, and Bush decided he didn't like that provision. So what did he do? He signed an earlier version of the bill. In other words, he signed a version that had never been passed by the House of Representatives. This is, you know, somewhat unconstitutional, and Conyers and his colleagues are suing in order to get that presidential signature rescinded, because Bush does not have the right under the Constitution to sign into law legislation that has not been passed in identical fashion by both houses. So again, keep an eye on this one, and it's yet another example of Bush making up the Constitution as he goes along. It's a very, very worrisome attitude on behalf of the White House.
All right. And I understand that Donald Rumsfeld is also being sued.
Yes, he is. He's being sued by six New York teenagers. And what they are suing him over, and the reason that those teenagers have standing, is that the Pentagon has, and this was announced late last year, or I don't think announced so much as reported, and the Pentagon verified it, that the Pentagon has been compiling a base of 12 million youth, age 16 and over, who are considered potential recruits for the military. And so the military has created this database that includes things like grades, results of aptitude tests, hobbies, interests, gender, race, ethnicity, etc. And some of the things that are compiled in that database, number one, they need to be erased after a period of time, and the Pentagon has not done that. But number two, even compiling some of the categories of information is illegal. And so the teenagers are suing, saying, look, this database shouldn't exist. It's an invasion of privacy, and it's illegal under federal statutes, and we'll see where that goes too.
Yeah, my understanding is for citizens in general here in the U.S. have approximately 850 some pieces of data collected on them in various databases around the country that are accessible to corporations.
Yeah, and if you know where to look, it's not just accessible to corporations. It's accessible to anybody who can get on the internet and look in the proper places. Privacy in this country has really become an illusion.
Moving along, you mentioned the Pentagon. The Pentagon is looking at letting some detainees go?
Yeah, there's about 500 prisoners remaining in Guantanamo Bay, and the Pentagon announced this week that it's going to release one-third of them It didn't say when it was going to release them. They've already been held in most cases for 4 or more years. And the Pentagon announced basically that these guys were innocent, that they posed no security threat to the United States so far as they could tell. Well, there's two questions here. One is why they were held so long in the first place when many of these cases, it has been pretty obvious that they were picked up by mistake or just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or, you know, somebody who didn't like them sold their name to Pakistani intelligence and it went from there, etc. The second question is, why can't they be released right now? Why are they continuing to be held in isolation, to be abused, in some cases to be tortured, you know, at Guantanamo Bay, when and we've learned all this from people who've been released in the past, and who suffered through that even though they were innocent, you know, why are these people continuing to be held? It's good news that they're going to be released, presumably, eventually, but it begs the question of why they can't get out now. Right. And you know, what happens to the remaining two-thirds of people who are in legal limbo and who are still being held under unmentionable conditions?
Jumping to international, Mexico is looking at some decriminalization.
Yes. The Mexican legislature passed on Friday, and Vicente Fox, who is the outgoing president, is expected to sign legislation that basically decriminalizes possession of a wide variety of drugs, not just marijuana, but cocaine, heroin, amphetamines, opium, all sorts of drugs that are being decriminalized in small amounts. And it specifies the amounts that are being decriminalized that you can have possession of. And in some cases, you know, they're fairly large personal use type of amounts. Now, buying and selling these drugs is still illegal, and the same legislation actually toughens laws for trafficking in larger amounts. But this is a piece of legislation that has truly alarmed the United States, and what they're afraid of course, is that in the same way that people go down to Tijuana to buy medications over the counter that are not available that way in the United States, that they're also going to go down to Tijuana and buy stuff that they can self-medicate with. Why people should be alarmed about the free market at its finest, I don't quite understand. But, good for Mexico, and we'll see what happens to this, because, of course, Mexico is a primary recipient of U.S., quote-unquote, assistance in terms of prosecution of the war on drugs. So there's going to be some friction over this, I would almost guarantee it.
All right. And jumping all the way over to Iraq. Any developments this week?
Oh, lots of developments this week in Iraq. We found out more about the new prime minister that was named literally as we were going on the air last Saturday. His name is... where did it go here? I haven't memorized it yet. Jawad al-Maliki. He is a hardline Shiite. He's just as hardline, if not more so, than al-Jafari, who's the guy that was basically forced out by pressure from the United States. He is basically a thug, and he has been very, very careful to advocate in all cases for more Shiite power and not for a centralized national government of unity. More interestingly still, this supposed national unity government that the United States forced the Shiites to adapt didn't include any of the secular parties, didn't include Alawi, any of those different parties. What they did is they made common cause with the radical clerics of the Sunnis and formed a government that way, and the same with the Kurds. So there is nobody in the national unity government among the various political parties involved that, number one, believes in a secular Iraq, number two, believes in a nationalist Iraq. All of these different parties want power devolved to the various provinces and constituencies. So it's not a national unity government. It's a government that's going to push very hard for the Shiites to have autonomy in the south, for the Kurds to have autonomy in the north, and for the Sunnis to be left holding the bag. It's also, in this case, al-Maliki does not believe at all, unlike his predecessor, in negotiating with the insurgency. So the opportunity for a political settlement of what has really become a civil war in Iraq seems to be much farther away than it was before the United States pushed for this government of national unity on the theory that it would prevent civil war. So once again, Washington seems to have screwed up and just made the situation in Iraq worse. That shouldn't really come as any surprise at this point. There were a number of other things that came out this week. The Washington Post revealed that six more U.S. inspections of Interior Ministry jails since we discovered that 173 people were being tortured and abused at a Interior Ministry jail in November. Six more jails have been inspected since then by the U.S. military, and in almost all of them there has been evidence of continuing prisoner abuse, continuing torture. It looks like this is an ongoing problem despite all of the U.S. diplomatic pressure to try and get it resolved, and will continue to be a problem as long as hardline Shiites and their militia continue to be in control of the Interior Ministry, continue to be in control of the National Police. That's where the death squad activity is coming from, and that's you know, a fair part of the reason why things are descending into civil war in Iraq. We have also this week a report in the New York Times that on Tuesday that, and I'll just say this as a direct quote, that troubled decision-making and execution was just as responsible as security concerns for the complete failure of reconstruction efforts in Iraq. In other words, there was a lot of waste, there were a lot of poor decisions, there was a lot of money that shouldn't have been spent that was on projects that were doomed from the beginning because of engineering problems. There's a lot of room for investigation of what American companies and the American government did to screw up reconstruction. It wasn't just a function of the fact that it was unsafe because of the insurgency, and that's kind of a major development. Well, 60 Minutes had a program Sunday night, which, like the New York Times report on NSA spying, a significant part of the 60 Minutes report had actually been scheduled to air before the 2004 elections, and it was a comprehensive overview of the evidence that the Bush administration not only lied, but as we now know, basically used a systematic campaign of lies and disinformation and scare tactics in order to stampede the country into war. The thing that was new that wasn't available in 2004 but that was aired last Sunday night is a top-ranking CIA analyst, or former CIA analyst, a guy named Tyler Drumheller, who says that, among other things, the United States had flipped, and the CIA actually had on its payroll and was talking to the foreign minister of Saddam Hussein's government before the invasion. So they had access to the inner circle of Saddam Hussein and everything they were talking about and everything they were deciding. Unfortunately, the White House dropped this guy as a source, as a hot potato, when he informed the Americans that the weapons of mass destruction that they were basing a war effort on actually had not existed since the early 1990s, that Iraq had destroyed them, which turned out to be true. So they got this directly from the Iraqi foreign minister in Saddam Dom's inner circle, who they had on their payroll as a source, and they not only didn't believe him, but discounted him as a source because he gave them that information. And when the CIA objected, what they were told was, this isn't a matter of intelligence, this is a matter of policy, and regime change is going to go on regardless. So they had all this information that WMD did not exist, and they convinced the American public otherwise.
That was an interview with Jav Parrish, analyzing recent news. You're listening to Making Waves. We now bring you labor news.
This is labor news. Information about most of us. You can find us on the internet at labornews.us. Our email is labornews.podcast@gmail.com. Write to us with comments and ideas. May 1st, 2006 felt like I was living in a democratic country again. Watsonville, a farmer's small town where labor news is produced, felt strange. It couldn't be any different in a place where 65% of the population is Latino. small restaurants, mom-and-pop stores like panaderias and mercados, body shops and garages, nail parlors and beauty salons were all closed. The traffic felt normal, though. Lots of people were moving around. Were they going to marches in the area? I was on my way to the University of California, Santa Cruz, where I teach Spanish. The students organized a walk out from there to add their numbers to those of workers and families from all around the city. About 1,000 young and enthusiastic blocked the entrance to campus and declared the area a border crossing, pronouncing illegals those who crossed. Few did. At noon, a surprisingly cooperative and friendly police force accompanied the protesters through some important avenues, such as the famous Highway 1, which crosses through the city. Moved by chants such as "Whose Streets Are Streets?" and "Si se puede," students sat for a few minutes at congested intersections and let everyone know they were there, ready to show how they felt. Farther ahead, 2,000 more from other parts of the city waited to march together to San Lorenzo Park, where speeches, music, and delicious food awaited. What people said showed they had a diverse set of reasons to be there, but all had one clear message in common. Foreign workers without legal documentation are human beings who deserve respect. Together and in unison, people from all walks of life stood up to say, these workers will not be invisible any longer. And, in this way, the people voted for respect to human dignity over selfish interests, and a little bit of democracy broke through the fog of politics. This was Labor News. Information about most of us.
And now, back to Jav Parrish for his commentary on Pacifica Radio about immigrants and hate.
Immigrants and hate. This is Jav Parrish. Monday, I was busy for most of the day helping provide security for the massive immigrant rights march here in Seattle. Organizers were concerned about a steady stream of virulent, anonymous death threats in the days leading up to the march, directed both at organizers and march attendees, and they didn't have nearly enough security to protect people adequately against such threats. Their fears, as it turned out, were well justified. At one point in the march, a car plowed into the crowd. A passenger in the car later called the driver's decision to drive into a street jammed with people a, quote, mental lapse. And, as the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reported in the 21st paragraph of their story, Seattle police reported the total of 7 people were arrested during the march, and those included 5 people for possible weapons violations. SPD said all 5 may have had permits for the weapons, however, and they've been released. That was fairly typical local media coverage. What SPD apparently did not say, but any organizer could have and perhaps did tell any local reporter whom cared to ask, was that the 5 were not marchers, as the PI's story intimated. They were self-identified neo-Nazis. And in the context of the large number of death threats organizers had received, there's only one possible explanation for their having come to the march armed with guns. It was march security that brought their presence to the attention of SPD. SPD also chose not to reveal, and no local media reported, a fact announced from the rally stage later on, that the car incident had resulted in several injuries. Seattle police were reportedly irritated with march organizers because the organizers, all of whom were non-white and most of whom were immigrants, for some reason didn't especially trust the police during the previous April 10th march here. So, among other things, SPD chose not to block traffic at intersections during the first 2 non-downtown miles of the march route along Jackson Street. And then we had a car injuring marchers. Happily, most marchers had no idea all this was going on, and the massive turnout was both joyful and inspiring. But the failure in particular of SPD and local media to report what was apparently a neo-Nazi assassination plot is more than just bad news judgment. It's a fundamentally biased news decision that lets the current wave of immigrant bashers and immigrant hating off the hook. Nationally, these were not isolated incidents. There's a direct line between the blatant misinformation and often racist xenophobia of media icons like Lou Dobbs, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and the whole Fox crew, and a wave of rabidly reactionary local talk show hosts across the country, and the actions of our neo-Nazi friends here in Seattle. Connect
the dots. There's plenty of room for disagreement on what to do about immigration policy in this country. The current system is clearly broken, with laws not being enforced and cheap labor often being badly exploited. What there is not room for in this debate is epidemic misinformation, xenophobic hatred, and fear of the visible edge of a world that is steadily encroaching on America's bubble. For the entire history of this country, starting with the genocide of Native Americans and the horrors of slavery, this country has prospered from the use of resources that properly belong to others. Now, finally, the world has no more unclaimed territories or obscure backwaters, and it's become small enough that we can no longer pursue such policies elsewhere in the world without blowback, whether it be 9/11 or a burgeoning immigrant workforce produced by policies that decimate foreign economies. We can no longer build enough walls to keep ourselves fully insulated from the consequences of our actions elsewhere. We'd be much better off, policy-wise, not even expecting that we can. And culturally, the world is changing. Get used to it. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jock Parrish.
Here comes Dave Lippman with Teenaged Immigrant Welfare Mothers on Drugs.
It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get... Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back. Send them back. Send them back.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some.
That was Dave Lippman with Teenage Immigrant Welfare Mothers on Drugs. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. And now we bring you Between the Lines, Independent Radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative reporter Jason Leopold, who examines why he believes Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is now seeking the indictment of Deputy White House Chief of Staff Karl Rove. Michael Zweig, professor of economics at the State University of New York, who examines the relationship between America's newly mobilized immigrant community and the labor movement, and Lexi Schultz of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who discusses the Bush administration's political manipulation of federal government science. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Independent newspaper reports the World Bank is being accused of breaking a pledge to fight malaria in Africa. In late April, 13 medical specialists blasted the World Bank, which has a $20 billion annual budget, of slashing its malaria staff to zero and promoting clinically obsolete treatments. The doctors are seeking an independent audit of the bank program called Roll Back Malaria, and a shift of $1 billion in World Bank funds to the UN Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. In 2000, 53 African leaders pledged to cut malaria deaths in half by the year 2010, and the World Bank promised to spend $300 million to fight malaria in Africa. So far, less than half that amount has been spent. In its defense, the World Bank admits the malaria program was understaffed and underfunded, but rejects the charge it has broken promises or hidden funds. The World Health Organization says 3,000 children die from malaria every day. The doctors maintain had a physician or a pharmacist behaved as the bank did, they would have been condemned or possibly sued for medical malpractice. With the retail price of gasoline surging past $3 a gallon, President George W. Bush gave the red carpet treatment to Ilham Aliyev, president of Azerbaijan, a powerful oil state in the volatile Caucasus region. The former Soviet republic of 8 million people shares a 380-mile border with Islamic Iran and is seen as a buffer against Russia's growing influence in the oil and natural gas market. President Aliyev will soon benefit from a windfall of petrodollars from the recently completed Baku to Turkey oil pipeline, which will bring 1 million barrels of oil a day onto the international market. The White House visit is of concern to human rights and anti-corruption groups who have long criticized Azerbaijan's government. As Human Rights Watch observed, Azerbaijan has a long history of unfair and corrupt elections and using politically motivated arrests to silence critics and opposition politicians. According to the Associated Press, the Bush administration is also courting two emerging oil states with poor human rights records, Kazakhstan and Equatorial Guinea. The Washington Post reports an Ohio coalition of Christian and Jewish clergy has filed two complaints with the Internal Revenue Service against two conservative churches, the World Harvest Church and the Fairfield Christian Church, for actively supporting the candidacy of Republican J. Kenneth Blackwell, the current Secretary of State, who is running for governor. A complaint filed in January accused the two churches and affiliated groups of permitting Republican organizations to use their facilities and illegally promoting Blackwell's candidacy, who in 2004 backed an Ohio ban on same-sex marriage. A new complaint filed in April states that the churches invited Blackwell to church-sponsored rallies and other events while not inviting any other candidate. Blackwell has also used a plane owned by World Harvest Church for trips. The IRS says 75% of the cases they've investigated have resulted in legal action, including a case against the liberal All Saints Church in Pasadena, California, for sermons against the Iraq War and attacks on social conservatives in the weeks prior to the 2004 election. In response to the complaints, Reverend Russell Johnson of the Fairfield Christian Church, who also heads the Ohio Restoration Project, called it spiritual warfare. Reverend Eric Williams, a United Church of Christ minister who signed the complaints, noted it's time for these churches to stop acting like electioneering organizations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
President Bush's senior counselor, Karl Rove, testified for 3.5 hours before a federal grand jury on April 26th. The political strategist's appearance was part of the continuing investigation by special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald into who in the White House leaked the name of covert CIA agent Valerie Plame in an effort to discredit her husband, Joseph Wilson, who challenged the president's rationale for the Iraq War. Just 1 week before he made his fifth appearance before the grand jury, Rove lost his position as Mr. Bush's chief policy coordinator in a White House shakeup. Sources close to the investigation have told reporters that Fitzgerald is now seeking an indictment of Rove for perjury committed in previous grand jury testimony and lying to investigators. Rove withdrew his original denials that he had no conversations with reporters concerning the identity of Valerie Plame after he learned that Time magazine's Matt Cooper would testify that he was a source for his Time story on Plame. In early April, Fitzgerald filed court documents revealing that indicted former Chief of Staff to Vice President Louis Libby testified that Dick Cheney had told him that President Bush personally authorized the release of classified intelligence in July 2003 to refute critics of his administration's rationale for war. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with investigative reporter Jason Leopold, who explains why he believes Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is now seeking the indictment of Karl Rove.
I reported that Karl Rove is, quote-unquote, a target of the investigation, that the special prosecutor has informed his attorney that there's enough evidence to link Karl Rove to a crime. His attorney denies it, and that's fine, but his attorney has also become part of the investigation. He's a witness in his own right. You know, I'm not accusing his attorney of lying. I'm just saying I have sources that are giving me other additional information. So this is, right now, this is a situation where we have to see what happens. We have to see what is going to eventually unfold. And from what I have been told, what is ultimately going to come down is that Karl Rove is going to be indicted. I also want to provide the reality here. Anything can happen at the very last minute. We're talking about a high-profile criminal case. And in all types of cases like this that involve crimes, you know, a suspect, if you will, could very well, you know, try to make a plea deal at the last minute. And I won't, and that could happen in this case. It very well could. It's, you know, until the grand jury actually votes to indict, that's when it happens. But at this point, with Karl Rove not trying to get a plea deal, what we have is perjury and lying to FBI investigators. There's a possibility, it's very likely that he will also be indicted for obstruction of justice. When he was first questioned about the case in October 2003, specifically how he found out about Valerie Plame Wilson, the covert CIA operative, and whether he shared that information with people in the media. Now, Karl Rove testified that he only shared information about Valerie Plame after he read about her in a newspaper report. Well, evidence has surfaced that, in fact, that is not the case. He was a source for Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper. And in addition to that, there have been emails, specifically an email that Karl Rove had sent to then-Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley shortly after his conversation with this Time magazine reporter, basically giving him an update on what they spoke about. And what they spoke about was Valerie Plame's husband, who at the time was a very vocal critic of the administration's pre-war Iraq intelligence. His name is Joseph Wilson, the former ambassador. There is no doubt that Karl Rove is in legal jeopardy. It's right now, it's a matter of when the hammer will fall, when he will find out.
There is some concern at the White House, from what I hear, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney could themselves be in jeopardy for having a hand in the campaign to discredit Joseph Wilson through the revelation of his wife's identity as a covert CIA agent.
That's absolutely correct. And the fascinating thing about this case is that how much more information will be revealed in the months ahead. And Scooter Libby's team, defense team, has already put out the warning that they will call the vice president and the president to testify. If anything, they have made it abundantly clear that they are not going to fall on their sword or he is not going to fall on a sword at this point, that he is going to take everyone down with him. And what we're about to see, I think, will be quite revealing and explosive. It may, in fact, confirm what we've already suspected, but it will be shocking nonetheless to find out that the president was in the know.
Well, I guess, Jason, I want to ask you the million-dollar question. Is the Bush presidency in jeopardy from this case? And if so, why?
Let's face it. You know, by the time Libby comes to trial, and perhaps if the grand jury does, in fact, vote to indict Rove, the Bush presidency may, in fact, be winding down. I think that ultimately, when all the facts do come out, you know, the history will be rewritten in terms of the Bush presidency. However, if we start learning more about this case, you know, come next January, or at least if the court filings provide more information, this definitely will be a failed presidency. And I cannot see how this president will, you know, will get any of the initiatives passed, because what will happen is that I think that people, the American people, are just going to be so fed up. And hopefully the Democrats, you know, will have some sort of message, some sort of unified message, where they can take back one of the houses or both of the houses and really promise to investigate this. And I think that's ultimately how it will be a failure. If we learn, you know, the president, what did he know and when did he know it, and if we get the answer to that question before November, look out, because this is, I do believe that the Democrats will call for an investigation, and there could possibly even be impeachment proceedings. I don't see how that they can get away with it.
That was investigative journalist Jason Leopold. Read his articles online at truthout.org. Leopold's just published book is titled News Junkie. The mobilization of hundreds of thousands of immigrants and their allies in over 200 cities around the U.S. on May 1st marked another historic moment in the rising consciousness and action of this once marginalized segment of the nation's population. Large numbers of immigrants participated in marches, rallies, boycotts, skipping school or work in what was billed as a day without immigrants. While Latinos comprised the largest number of participants, thousands of immigrants from the Caribbean, Asia, and Europe also joined in the day's activities. The driving force behind the outpouring of activism in the immigrant community was the passage of legislation in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives that would criminalize the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. and those who assist them. Negotiations over less draconian immigration reform proposals that could lead to legalization are pending in the Senate. The immigration protests coincided with May Day, the international workers' holiday born out of the struggle for an 8-hour workday, the 1886 Chicago Haymarket bombing, and the subsequent hanging of four activists. In recent years, unions in the U.S. have been drawing closer to the struggle for immigrant rights, not least because these millions of unorganized workers could help provide new members to a labor movement that has been on the decline over the last three decades. Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with Michael Zweig, professor of economics at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life. Zweig examines the relationship between America's newly mobilized immigrant community and the labor movement.
Well, I think that we have a real mark that's been made this year, starting in April, with the demonstrations that were in Los Angeles and also in Dallas and all over the country, North Carolina, Ohio, Chicago, Milwaukee, in New York earlier in April, and now this May 1st thing all over the country again. It's very plain and very clear that we have a very large and mobilized immigrant population which seeks fair and decent treatment at work and seeks fair treatment before the law. And I think it's going to be difficult for Congress to pass legislation which criminalizes these millions and millions of people and converts them into felons and converts anyone who gives them any help or service also into criminals. I think that we're seeing a social movement here that is going to have a very profound effect on the law.
It seems that the AFL-CIO and organized labor have changed their position in recent years to immigrants, trying to embrace them rather than seeing them as a threat. You want to make a comment on that?
Well, I think that that is right. From the beginning of the AFL, American Federation of Labor, as a confederation, a collection of trade unions, mainly in the skilled trades and crafts, beginning actually back in 1886, at the same time as the Haymarket events that gave us May Day, the AFL unions have been traditionally very much focused on the interests of their own members and have been characterized by a lot of racism, a lot of sexism, and a lot of nativism and anti-immigrant feelings. And those sentiments, particularly the sentiments against immigrant labor, have been characteristic of American unions up until really just about the year 2000, just about 5 or 6 years ago, when the AFL-CIO finally figured out that immigrant labor are working people and need to be organized and need to have the same rights that every other worker has, regardless of their immigration status, because the entire working population, the entire working class of America needs those rights, and you can't defend those rights for some workers and disregard them for other workers. So in the last 5 or 6 years, the American labor movement has really turned around 180 degrees and has become pretty much a full-throated proponent of immigrant labor rights. And I think we've seen that in events like the Immigrant Freedom Ride that was organized by the unions in this country about 3 years ago, where thousands and thousands of immigrant workers from all over the country came to New York City in caravans that came all across the country and had rallies in cities everywhere they went. So that was the first real public organizing step that the labor movement took, were those freedom rides. And what we see now is a continuation of that, but driven not just by unions, but by immigrant labor organizations that are not unions, but do represent immigrant labor.
As we have this outpouring of immigrants' rights activists all over this country on May Day, the traditional workers' holiday, do you think that the mobilization of immigrants around the current issues in Congress will later on to improve the fortunes of organized labor, of labor unions who've been losing membership over the last 20, 30 years?
American labor movement is very much on the defensive and has been losing members. One impetus for them, for the unions to take an interest in immigrant workers is the obvious point that if you're going to organize workers and immigrants are the workers, those are the people you're going to be organizing, and you have to pay attention and you have to really be internal and integrated with and supportive of immigrant labor. So I think that as we see these immigrant workers from Latin America, from China, from Eastern Europe, from Poland, out marching and out organizing as workers, and with the support and with the resources devoted to it by regular unions too, that it can only help to turn the organizing campaigns around in industries where these workers are, where we find them. So I think we see, for example, the Service Employees and Union is doing a lot of work organizing immigrants. The restaurant workers and the hotel workers doing a lot of work organizing immigrants. The laborers, a lot of work organizing on construction sites all over the country and here in New York as well and in Connecticut. So I think we do see a convergence here of interest and of energy, and I think that there may be in it an element of a turnaround as working people increasingly take to the streets and take to more militant and more class-wide actions to defend their interests.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics at the State University of New York and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life. Learn more about the immigrant rights movement by visiting immigrantsolidarity.org. In the latest of many decisions that put politics ahead of science, the Bush administration's Food and Drug Administration in mid-April issued a ruling that no sound scientific studies support the medical use of marijuana. This contradicts a 1999 report issued by the Institute of Medicine, a part of the National Academy of Sciences, which is the nation's most prestigious scientific advisory body. That review found marijuana to be useful for treating nausea and vomiting from chemotherapy used in cancer treatment and for reducing the wasting impact of AIDS. 11 states have legalized the medicinal use of marijuana, but the Drug Enforcement Administration and the director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy have opposed those laws. Other issues where science has collided with the Bush administration's right-wing ideology include downplaying the existence of climate change, calling on scientists to alter their data to show that mercury pollution is less damaging to health than scientific studies originally showed, and concerns around reproductive health. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Lexi Schultz, Washington representative for scientific integrity at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She compares President Bush's manipulation of science to that of previous administrations and explains what UCS and other groups are doing to help restore scientific integrity to policymaking.
It's clear that political interference in science has become pervasive within this administration. Across a broad array of agencies on a large number of issues, when the science is not supported, this administration's predetermined policy agenda, the administration has chosen to manipulate, suppress, censor, distort scientific information. We've heard from scientists and advisors to past administrations, both Republican and Democratic, that this interference in science, while not brand new, is certainly happening at an unprecedented level and across an unprecedented number of issues. Politics has been allowed to interfere with science on issues that affect us all. One of the biggest environmental topics has been global warming. And there have been a number of different cases where the administration has chosen to either suppress scientific information or to try to distort it so that it appears that the science around global warming is uncertain, and in so doing, to try to reduce the urgency of the need to take action. And all of this fits the administration's policy agenda of not taking immediate action on global warming.
In addition to environmental issues, another area where this manipulation of science seems to be prevalent is in the arena of health, like the example we saw most recently regarding medical marijuana, and specifically in the area of women's reproductive health, and even more specifically in the holding up of the availability of emergency contraception.
The Food and Drug Administration ignored not one but two different science advisory panels that were looking at the question of whether it was safe to sell emergency contraception, so-called Plan B, over-the-counter, and then whether, in fact, the government should make this drug available over-the-counter. And the scientists said that this drug is extremely safe, and the FDA not only ignored the scientists on the panel, but then came out with their own pseudoscientific reason for denying approval to the drug. They said that there was no evidence that the drug wouldn't affect young girls differently than other women. But in fact, there's never been any studies that any drug, that this drug should have an impact different on young children. And they came up with this totally on their own. And what they're trying to do here is distort scientific information in order to justify their reasoning.
Lexi Schultz, your organization is called the Union of Concerned Scientists. So as concerned scientists, what are you doing to raise the alarm about this issue?
Well, absolutely. The Union of Concerned Scientists has an entire program on scientific integrity, and we're working both to raise awareness about the problem and about the impacts of the problem for all of our lives, because, of course, these decisions are not happening in a vacuum. We've issued two reports about different examples of political interference in science, and we released, along with one of these reports, a statement that had been signed by 62 very prominent scientists, including Nobel laureates. This was back in 2004, calling for a restoration of scientific integrity and policymaking. That statement has now been signed by more than 9,000 scientists. One of the other things we're doing is trying to survey scientists within federal agencies anonymously so that scientists who are feeling this kind of pressure or intimidation can make their voices better heard. Overall, the picture that's being shown is that these scientists definitely are feeling a chilling effect. Many of them are extremely proud of the scientific work that they are doing, but they feel that political interference in science is hampering the ability of the agencies to do their jobs, and that's extremely troubling. And it's troubling also because these agencies may be losing the best and brightest scientists. There have already been a number of people who've resigned, and it's going to be extremely hard for the U.S. to retain its world leadership in science if we continue with this type of abuse. But we are very interested in solutions. We have been working with an array of science-based groups, of watchdog advocacy groups. It's also true that the National Academy of Sciences came out with a report where they specifically decried the practice of asking science advisors, these are people who serve on science advisory committees, questions such as, did you vote for President Bush, or do you support this particular president's policies? There are two bills. There's a House bill and a Senate bill, both of which are called Restoring Scientific Integrity, that would at least fix part of the problem. The bills right now have a number of co-sponsors, but they have not been given hearings. And certainly, these are bills that deserve hearings. So we hope to advance those in the future.
That was Lexi Schultz, Washington representative for scientific integrity at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the group by calling area code 202-223-6133 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. we leave you with this quote by Nelson Mandela, who, on May 10, 1994, became president of South Africa after 300 years of colonial rule. To be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others.